And now,
the definition.
Since daddy had to fly, but I knew a place where we can go, still untouched by men. So watch the clouds roll back, the tall grass fades in the wind. You can lay your head back on the ground, let your hair fall off.
Man 67. I want to talk about Charlottesville. Told you so. With Trump in office, this is only going to get worse. Trump has made it fashionable to be a bigot. These people have always been here. They're like cockroaches. It's like when you turn on the lights on in the kitchen and you see all the cockroaches coming out. This will only get worse. What happened to Charlottesville no longer surprised me. Now we have Donald Trump in office, and his mentality, the coded language that he used, the racist and bigoted rhetoric, this does not surprise me that this is happening. With all the questionable police shootings and the theory that white supremacists infiltrated law enforcement, it's a scary time in America right now. I think this is the worst race relations have been in this country probably since the early 60s, late 50s. It's getting bad. And, you know, it's like we're walking on eggshells here.
And stark displays of racism, exploding into a deadly act of domestic terror. Tonight, we examine the hateful groups that now appear to be banding together. Why are they now emerging from the shadows, emboldened and growing in numbers? Here's ABC's Eva Pilgrim.
Hate no longer hides behind hoods.
This was the scene in the liberal college town of Charlottesville, Virginia on Friday, reminiscent of images from a dark American past. Hundreds of white nationalists from across the country descended upon the University of Virginia's campus ahead of a planned demonstration to protest the removal of the statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee.
White lives matter! White lives matter!
They quickly clashed with counter-protesters, people from both sides ready to fight. It would be the start of a bloody 24 hours. Tonight, as division seemed wider than ever, President Trump returned to New York City.
New York hates you, Donald Trump.
The welcome?
Nobody
anything but warm. Earlier today, the president spoke from the White House directly condemning hate groups for the first time since the events over the weekend.
Racism is evil, and those who cause violence in its name are criminals and thugs, including the KKK. Neo-Nazis, white supremacists, and other hate groups that are repugnant to everything we hold dear as Americans.
But some, even in his own party, saying those words came too late about an incident that has become a new American flashpoint.
Let it shine, let it shine, let it shine.
It's early Saturday morning in Charlottesville. On the one side, 26-year-old Matt Heimbach, one of the leaders of a white nationalist group preparing for today's Unite the Right demonstration, thought to be the largest gathering of white supremacists in the U.S. in decades, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center.
We're here to stand for Robert E. Lee because they're removing the Robert E. Lee statue. We're here to say that we're here to defend our heritage.
Shame on you!
On the other side,
no hate, no fear. White supremacists not welcome here.
Daryl Lamont Jenkins, leader of the One People's Project.
We are here today because a number of white supremacists decided to hold this massive rally, the third one that they've had in, I guess, as many months. It's supposed to be one of the larger ones.
Jenkins' organization monitors and publishes information about alleged racist and supremacist groups.
Is this guy wearing a Hitler shirt? Yes, he is. I'm just going to take a picture of him.
I support the courageous folks.
Why do you videotape them?
Because people need to know who they are.
His group has joined with many others to counter the white supremacist message.
The same spirit of hate.
People like Matt Heimbach see it differently.
We're doing the Lord's work. What is there to be nervous about if you're doing the Lord's work?
Nightline co-anchor Byron Pitts first met Heimbach 3 years ago. He's a young man who, back then, had been called the future of the white supremacist movement by someone we want to know. A former Grand Wizard of the KKK.
Do you see a young David Duke in Matt Heimbach?
If you combine honesty, sincerity with intelligence, I think he has the potential to be quite an effective leader for these ideas.
Racist, racist, anti-gay!
Do you consider yourself a racist?
Sure. So what? I call it natural.
Being a racist is natural.
Loving one's people is natural.
In 2014, we watched as he and his tiny contingent protested at Indiana University and got sprayed by water.
Get out of here!
You don't want to have a reasonable discussion. You want to come and you want to piss people off.
But like the national movement he belongs to, Heimbach seemed to have a new confidence. And now, this weekend, the bearded, helmeted Heimbach, surrounded by hundreds of supporters, seemed very different.
Shields up!
Ready.
Pull the back up! Hey! Hey! Hey!
Yeah. Are you prepared to die today?
Of course. I wouldn't be here if I wasn't.
His group enters the melee, counter-protesters and white nationalists clashing again.
Get the out of Charlottesville! This is not your town!
The crowd beating one another with sticks and metal rods. I asked one of the white nationalist protesters, why bring weapons if this was a peaceful protest?
Because we were afraid the police might not defend us.
They ripped my flag off, tried to grab it. Three, four people started hitting me with some kind of sticks.
Local and state police respond in riot gear, using pepper spray, trying to push demonstrators back.
Leave the immediate area or you will be arrested.
Graphic images like this, showing 20-year-old DeAndre Harris being beaten with sticks, going viral.
We were walking down, they bum rushed us, and they just
beat me with the polls.
Just before noon, Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe declares a state of emergency. Then, that terrible moment. When the driver of this gray Dodge mows down a group of marchers who were protesting the rally, he rams into one group, then puts his car in reverse and accelerates, running over several more before fleeing the scene.
Car just plowed through hundreds of people downtown Charlottesville.
Hit like two or three other cars and pinned people in between the cars, smashed into people.
The driver is identified as 20-year-old James Alex Field from Maumee, Ohio. Just before the attack, Fields was caught by our ABC cameras chanting a message of white power.
White freedom now! White freedom now!
19 people were injured. 32-year-old Heather Heyer was killed. Heather's mother told us her daughter was there protesting white supremacy.
I'm extremely proud that she stood for what she believed in. She gave soul to it, and now she's given her life to it.
Shortly after, a Virginia State Police helicopter monitoring the rally crashed outside Charlottesville, killing two. Fields was arrested and faces several charges, including second-degree murder. He has not yet entered a plea. The Justice Department and FBI are also opening a civil rights investigation into the incident.
This is a case that's very, very high profile. Mr. Sessions has made it really, really clear that he is going to be tough on crime and expect him to carry it through.
Fields' mother, who learned of the incident on camera,
did it hurt anybody?
Says she knew her son was driving the 8 hours from Ohio to Virginia for a rally, but didn't know what for.
I didn't know it was white supremacists. I thought it had something to do with Trump.
The premeditated violence that our community experienced today was completely unacceptable.
But some critics found the police response unacceptable as well.
At the point that it turned violent, why didn't you guys clear the streets completely? Why allow any protesters at that point to remain on the streets?
We did clear the park. We were following a number of groups, ensuring that they were being peaceful. But it was a challenge. It was certainly a challenge. We were spread thin once the groups dispersed.
Do you think the city did everything they could to protect the people here?
We had 1,000 law enforcement personnel on the ground, city of 50,000 people to deal with, thousands of people coming here. I am not going to criticize or second guess our first responders.
As the horrific scenes of hatred and violence played out on Saturday, the first White House response came not from the president, but from the first lady, who tweeted, "Our country encourages freedom of speech, but let's communicate without hate in our hearts. No good comes from violence. Hashtag Charlottesville." But when the president finally spoke, he seemed to blame both the white nationalists and the counter-protesters.
"We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides. On many sides."
When the president failed to condemn neo-Nazis and white supremacists by name, and originally the white supremacist felt as if he had given them a pass.
His response drawing criticism even from members of his own party. Republican Senator Cory Gardner tweeted, "Mr. President, we must call evil by its name. These were white supremacists, and this was domestic terrorism." Reporters pushing the president even further.
"Mr. President, do you want the support of these white nationalist groups who say they support you, Mr. President? Have you denounced them strongly enough?"
It wasn't until today, 2 days later, that the president finally called the hate groups out by name.
"The average American should be distressed that it took so long for the president of the United States to condemn the Ku Klux Klan and neo-Nazis after demonstrations which resulted in death in Charlottesville, Virginia."
Tonight, police in Charlottesville vowing to make more arrests as they pore over videos of the violent clashes from the weekend.
"We're all still grieving in Charlottesville. We're still praying. But we're also starting to get back on our feet and look toward the future."
The country now struggling to do the same. For Nightline, I'm Eva Pilgrim in Charlottesville, Virginia.
Class war, class war, class war.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
Class war, class war. Take the beat, class war.
attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When the system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, it's your brother Vine Mayor Deese. Welcome to another episode of the Class War Battlefield. Oh, Charlottesville. Oh, Charlottesville. I was not going to record an episode for this. Honest to God, I was not going to do it. And then listening to Trump still gets me, ladies and gentlemen. I got to be honest. Still gets me that I have to say President Trump. Still gets me. Listening to him, listening to other people talk about it, a couple of radio shows, a couple of podcasts, I found myself in disbelief. And the primary reason for that is the majority of the people who I was listening to didn't seem to understand the severity of what is actually happening. And I think the primary reason for this is the majority of them look at this incident. They look at the incident. They don't contextualize it with anything else. It's just an incident. A young woman who's killed was caught up in an incident. It was a one-time thing. When in fact, that couldn't be furthest from the truth. This upswelling is partially due to Barack Obama's ascension to the presidency. It is partially due to the idea of Black Lives Matter. And it is partially due with the idea surrounding white genocide. Which, by the way, is a alarmist term for an actual phenomenon. White birth rates are in fact declining all throughout the world, and it's been this way for at least 30 years. They've been in a negative. You're talking Europe, you're talking the United States, and I think just about every state in the United States, if not completely in all states, but in Europe, the US, Canada, Australia, all throughout the world, wherever white people congregate, their birth rates are in the sub-zero category. They are not even keeping up with mortality rates. Part of this is due, of course, to the fact that more and more white people are getting married to more and more non-white people. But that is not it. That's not it. Infancy mortality rates are higher, slightly, not dramatically. More and more white people are deciding to have children later in life when they believe they can afford them. And more of them are deciding to have fewer kids, which is causing the plummet in birth rate. This is not something new. There has been articles written about this for the last 30 years. This is not something new. But with the ascendancy of non-white people to the highest branches of office in both Europe and the United States, white people are becoming frightened, and particularly the elements which are prone to violent reaction. Progressives, those moderates who consider themselves lefties when in fact they're more centrist than not, and do very little to quell this type of thing, see no parallels in the development of these people and their proneness to violence and the economic troubles that are now starting to afflict white people. And to the extent, of course, that they do see the parallels, they don't see, or I used the word parallels at the wrong time, but they don't see the connection very often to the economic troubles that are happening and starting to afflict white communities when, of course, those troubles in the 90s, in the early 2000s, were really concentrated in black communities. And this blind spot prevents them from seeing the parallels between this period of time and what happened in the early 30s and the 20s, when lynchings, when there was economic downturns, lynchings went up dramatically. So therefore, when I'm seeing these people protesting, I'm hearing about cops shooting black people, I'm putting all of this together. These are all connected. Now, I have heard, as some of the people who are marching in the neo-Nazi, the alt-right, white supremacist group have been identified, these individuals were getting fired from jobs and people were dismissing them from their neighborhood, saying, you know, I don't know how they could possibly hold these ideas. And first and foremost, I do not agree with these people being fired from their jobs. And the reason I don't believe these people should be fired from their jobs is because if an individual can be dismissed because they're a Nazi, because they're a white supremacist, because they share these things which other people don't agree with, the same thing can be done to leftists. Remember, I warned that I felt like the pounding of the drums for Russia, saying that Russia was this, Russia was that, was just a setup to go after leftists in the 20s. This is a dangerous precedent, ladies and gentlemen. You don't want to start down this road with conservatives, because ultimately, most business people are conservatives themselves. They're getting rid of the undesirable conservatives to them. But do not mistake that the majority of these business people, if push came to shove, and they had to choose between left leftists, conscious, stricken people who are saying we need a better society, you need to treat your employees better, we maybe need to turn this into a cooperative. Do not hesitate to believe that these same people wouldn't turn their backs on you and then join with these other people. Join with these other people to crush you. Understand how allyships work. Understand how allyships work. These people will use this precedent to isolate you and to crush you and to kick you out of their companies. They will do it. They will do it. Don't support these type of things. Now, to the broader questions, and by the way, this isn't me defending these people. They have the right to believe what they want to believe. But you don't isolate them this way. Why? Because then they're just going to take that as another excuse and another reason to see society in the way that they see it. Most of these people, you're not going to change their mind anyway. But what you can hope to do is to corner them and box them in so they can't spread what they're saying and what they're doing. If every company, every neighbor says that they do not believe what they believe, what these other white supremacists and Nazis believe, and they truthfully don't believe them or believe what they believe, then why run from them? Why run from them? Why expel them? Okay, so you have a neo-Nazi over there. What does that change? Oh, well, if I'm associated with them, then people might think I'm a neo-Nazi. People might think... You and I both know there are conversations which would happen where such questions would be raised, and all you'd have to say is, I have no clue why he believes what he believes, but I don't believe it. And the neighbors, maybe after a period of speculation about each other, will then settle down and say, yeah, okay, we don't believe what he believes. All right, that doesn't even affect us. Let him stay there. We don't even care. We don't even care. But my argument actually is this, because I was listening to a local radio station, and the host was talking about this, and the question kept coming up. How does a person believe this in today's day and age, which I find laughable? I find laughable how short memories white folks are enabled to have. These same people forget when Barack Obama came in, you had government officials. And throughout his terms, you had government officials making racist statements. And not just in the South, either. But they kept asking the question, how do you believe this? Where does it come from? And I'm going to tell you where it comes from. It comes from society. It comes from society. White people believe in white supremacy. I'm not gonna vindicate your hurt feelings by saying, oh well, not all white people. That isn't what's gonna happen here. So saddle up, because this is gonna be a little painful for some of y'all. But for the rest of you, I don't know what your problem's going to be. You know what I'm about to say is true. You know it, whether you want to admit it or not. White society has never dealt with the fact that its participants, its people, support white supremacy, need white supremacy, desire white supremacy, and if they didn't have it, they would feel empty and removed and unable to function. White supremacy is demonstrated in so many different ways, many micro, and others not so micro. You and I both know, if you are white, even if you are black, you know this. And if you are non-black or non-white, brown people, yellow people, red people, white people talk about race, and they often do it in disparaging and racist ways, even often when they say they are not. So, for instance, a white person might speak of that no good black guy that their daughter is dating, and then talk about, oh, that Jamal, who she used to date, was such a good kid. Oh, I loved him. He was awesome. He was a good person. In that instance, he might actually be a kid. But I've heard 33 and 23-year-olds being referred to as kid and kids. And when I ask him about that, I say, well, how old is he? Oh, he's 33. He's 23. Oh, so this young man or this man used to date her. Yeah. Why'd you call him a kid? I was thinking like 16. Oh, well, to me, everybody's a kid. Ah. Really? Well, your other daughter is dating a white guy, and you call him guy. You may even call him man. You do not call that white guy a kid. Why? Oh, that's a slip of the tongue. It's not. Kid is akin to boy. We all know that this happens. We all know what white people say, sometimes to our faces. But oftentimes, if you're white, you know this more than I do. White people get together, they're talking about politics, they're talking about whether it was Barack Obama or some issue like Ferguson or Baltimore. You know the things that your friends say. You know it. And if you demonstrate that you're not with that type of speech, they stop talking about it around you. But you and I both know they're not, their views haven't changed. They just don't talk about it around you. So with this knowledge in hand, how can you ask where this came from? Where this came from? And it's not about male or female, because I know a lot of the feminists will say, oh, well, you know, it's a masculine thing. It's a patriarchy thing. It's not. Some of the most vicious, most dedicated racists I have ever met. And by the way, most effective racists I have ever met were white females. Which actually stands to reason, because white females, just like all females, are emotional creatures. They are creatures of social norms and social cultures. Social customs. Meaning, they understand the intricacies of working in the group and group dynamics. They know how to motivate and steer and mold a group secretly. They can underhand it, or they can cause it to prosper and flourish. Women know this. All women know this. And so, when they want to get a message across, and any guy, any male who's married or been in a long-term relationship knows this also. When women want to get a specific goal accomplished or they want to communicate something without communicating it verbally, they give you looks, they give you signs, they shoot daggers, all that kind of stuff. This makes them the most efficient racists out there because they can cloak what they want to do in another action, only revealing their ultimate goal by the totality of what they're doing. Men, on the other hand, usually don't do this, and if they do this, they usually couch it in intellectual form, strategy, tactics, where women, it's just intergroup dynamics, and it comes natural. Men, you have to usually teach this to. So, we can't ask the question. It's not even a question. Where did this come from? How do they hold these views? I know what their parents are saying. I don't care what their parents are saying. When I was a young man, there was a friend that I had. Actually, he wasn't my friend. His brother was my friend, one of my school friends. And his brother was a classmate of my younger brother. So we were holding a little barbecue at our house. Actually, we were country people. We were living in a trailer at the time. So we invited him out, and we were playing football. And my three brothers were whipping these kids, just beating them completely. And they played organized football. We just ran all over them. And in a moment of frustration, he dropped nigger on us. My brother's friend, who was the brother of my friend. And my friend said, "Yo, you don't say that." But didn't look shocked. Did not look shocked. His parents said that, you know, you're in trouble. You know, they arrived. My mom told him what had happened. And said, "Are you crazy? You don't say that. You know, you're going to be in trouble when we get home. Yada, yada, yada." We heard nothing about it. Nothing more of it. My feeling was that he didn't just pick that up randomly. And from being around the family, there was definitely some tension with black people. Most families, most white families that I had frequented when I was a child, there was always that bit of tension with black people. And yet, because I was articulate, because I was considered to be, quote, smart, that tension wasn't there. Because as I was told multiple times growing up, and I mean this, when I say multiple times, ladies and gentlemen, I'm talking about probably 60, 70 times a year I was told this. And I'm not joking. So many people told it to me that it became a mantra for a while. Once I graduated from school. You don't act black. Because I didn't act black. Because I didn't act black. I was a good one. It took me a long time to be able to finally get to the point where I was saying to myself, "Well, wait a minute, how do I not act black? I'm black. How can I act any differently?" And considering I studied Martin Luther King, who was very articulate and unashamedly black, although it took him a long time to say that, he was more Negro than black for a long time. Same with Malcolm, Marcus Garvey, Asada, and many others. Terribly, terribly, terribly articulate people. And I say terribly only because it was a fear of white people that they were articulate. But even Bill Cosby, who I loved growing up, he was a doctor on his TV show, of course, and articulate, but also unashamedly black. It was never said that he didn't act black. It was never said that he did not act black. But I didn't act black. And that was supposed to be a good thing. The point, of course, is this is all racism. But to a very, very subtle degree. Because racism, when it blossoms, is institutional. And I hate that word. I try not to say that. I try not to say systemic. Because it takes away the individuality of racism. It takes away that individuality. It takes it from a personal level and says, oh, well, the person really has nothing to do with it. It's just ingrained in the systems, and if we were to get rid of the systems, and everything would be fine. No. It's a European cultural problem. You either deal with it on that level, or it'll never cure itself. And of course, the question is, can it cure itself? I'm always reminded that racism and the dominating of other people and other cultures and the taking stuff from those other people and other cultures has always been a core element to the Europeans' existence. Specifically, well, as far as black people go, the majority of us, not Northern Africa. You're talking the last 500 years plus. That being the case, how likely is it that racism and its extensions are going to really be done away with? Moreover, the history of Europe itself is one of extreme conquest, extreme betrayal, extreme isolation and desolation, and all of that combined. And that was before, and even to an extent after, imperialism started. Which begs the question, how much of what we are into can really be solved. To Charleston specifically, I am saddened by the young lady whose life was lost. We need good people on this planet. So to lose a person who was doing well and doing good is always tragic and terrible. On the other side of that, away from her death, I want you to see the, excuse me, the impact of her death as symbolic to the idea of why black lives do not matter. Republicans, even Fox News, conservatives throughout the country, mostly, not all, denounced her. The guy who actually killed her denounced everything he stood for, even though most of them still believe in what he stands for. they painted, some of them, good portraits of who this woman was, even though she was not a rightist. And yet, these same people had not one positive thing to say about Philando Castile or Alton Sterling. For them, blue lives mattered until this white girl dropped dead. White lives mattered to them, which is why her death is a tragedy. Black lives do not still matter. All right, ladies and gentlemen, this concludes the first segment of today's show. I'm going to go to a quick music break, then I'll see you on the other side. This is by Mayor Deese.
Come gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters above you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you'd better stop swimming or you'll sink. For the times, they're changing. Come, writers and critics who prophesy with your pen, and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again.
Changing.
it is cast. And the slower now will later be fast, as the present now will later be past. The order is rapidly fading. All the first one now will later be last. All the times they are changing,
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is your brother, Vitamin Deese. Welcome to this Class War Battlefield Podcast segment. I guess I should just call this part three. There's a point that I think needs to be brought up about the protests and the counter-protests, which would have not been readily apparent to me if I had not moved to the community that I moved to a few years back, and had something very strange and really unbelievable happen that made me want to think about this. The summer of George Zimmerman's trial, I moved to a new community, and I was immediately inundated by a number of people who I was working with and who I was around, who wanted to tell me, and they did, about a Ku Klux Klan rally that happened about 25 years ago, and how all of the town people got together, white people mostly, and chased them out of town. I heard this, and I'm not exaggerating when I say this, ladies and gentlemen. I heard this about 50 times in my first 6 months being here. Maybe my first 4 months being here. I heard it often from people who I was just, I would meet in the grocery store and say, hey, how you doing? You know, hey, well, you know, where do you live? I've never seen you around here before. I just moved here. Oh, yeah, all right. And then they proceed to tell me. It was almost like it was standard scripting. So I was kind of, you know, intrigued by that in the beginning. The first couple times I heard it, I was like, oh, okay, that's pretty cool, man. All right, I'm in a progressive town. All right, this is great. But then the more and more I heard it, the more I started getting suspicious. And I started wondering, why are so many white people telling me this? Now, on the flip side, an older black gentleman friend of mine, who had lived in this community all his life, had told me, excuse me, when you move here, understand there's a lot of racism. And they'll deny it, but there's a ton of racism. And my first immediate response was, whatever, you know, son, that's cool. I'm a studier of Martin Luther King. You know, I love everybody. I'm not worried about that. They'll see that I'm a hard worker. I'm a good guy, whatever. It's not going to really impact me. I was wrong. And I realized from my experiences in this town over the last 4 or 5 years that it is absolutely incorrect. People don't not like you because of stereotypes. They not like you because you're black. People do not treat you the way that they do, call you the names that they call you because of stereotypes. They do it because you're black. And so I hadn't come to this conclusion yet. It still took a couple of years. So I was becoming intrigued by the fact that all these white people were telling me this. Why are you all telling me this story as if I need to know it? And so it wasn't for a couple of years when I was hearing people talk about Michael Brown and the problems of Ferguson and Black Lives Matter. And I was hearing them say some of the most disparaging and cruel things about black people. When I started to really understand that these people didn't run and chase the Klan out because they didn't believe their ideology, they chased them out because they didn't want the competition. They didn't want overt racism. They had instituted a system of, to black people, it was overt. But to white people, it was deniable. So they had implemented a code of conduct for themselves where racism was very apparent, but it was just subtle enough where they could deny it. They didn't want the competition. They weren't chasing them out because they didn't believe what they want, what they were saying. They chased them out because they didn't want the competition. Or as they used to say in the old South, we don't want you coming around stirring up our niggas. And that's exactly what it was. So when I see these counter-protesters, I understand that the majority of them out there are probably out there for that reason. I'd like to believe, ladies and gentlemen, I'm not joking when I tell you this. I'd like to believe otherwise. I'd love to believe that the majority of them out there, because some of them are out there specifically for that purpose, because they don't want the competition. And it looks fashionable. So they can get points. They can get points for being non-racist right now. So then later when somebody's like, oh, well, you just said something racist, or you're acting racist, they can just say, oh, well, are you crazy? I was out there chasing those white supremacists away. I was out there chasing those neo-Nazis away. Those Klansmen. I was chasing them away. So how are you going to call me racist? Ask my friend Tyrone over here, who was right next to me. Tyrone, am I racist? Oh, no. Julie, Tommy, whatever. They're one of the most down people I know, man. They ain't racist. And that's what they're out there for. But I'd love to believe that the majority of them are out there to truthfully get rid of racism. But most of them, as soon as they get done with this rally, they're not writing their city councilmen and women. They're not going into their associations and their clubs and saying, you are going to change the economic conditions of black people. You are going to change the things that are affecting black people negatively. Most of these people ain't doing that. So they're not countering, they're not trying to eliminate racism. They're just protesters. And protesting don't mean nothing to me. What do you do after the protests? What do you do after the protests? This was a point that needed to be made, ladies and gentlemen. And it's a point that you need to keep in the back of your head. Because it's time that people really check themselves. You gotta check yourself now. If you consider truthfully that you are a social justice warrior, understand what it really means. You're on 24 hours a day. You are making systemic change. If you are not able to make that systemic change, then you're not a social justice warrior. And when I say systemic change, understand you are white and you got privilege. If you believe that, and by the way, I don't even like the word privilege because if you really compare privilege and supremacy, there's some clear similarities. But okay, you believe you have white privilege. How are you utilizing that privilege to destroy and dismantle racism? I'm not talking about getting up, talking about a speech, delivering a paper, writing an article, per se. Sometimes articles and papers are needed. But if you got white privilege, that means you have an inroad. Excuse me, to the power mechanisms of the society. You can use those inroads to change those power mechanisms. How are you doing that? If you are not doing that, I can't help you. Now, there's a concept of the radical, which was very big in the 60s. These people were putting their minds and their bodies on the power mechanisms and trying to stop them from functioning. How many of you can truthfully say you're doing that? How many? How many? And I'm not talking about just to be fashionable. I'm talking about doing it. All right, ladies and gentlemen. This is Ryan Deese. I'll see you. Peace.
Love come quick. Love come in a hurry. There are thieves in the temple tonight. They don't care where they kick, just as long as they hurt you. There are thieves in the temple tonight. Love, if you're there, come save me from all this cold despair.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is your brother, Vimer Deese. You know, I'd really contemplated leaving this as a one-segment show. But, events mitigate otherwise. Mitigates me to kind of push my boundaries and extend my comments. The first segment probably was hard to listen to for a lot of European Americans, so-called white Americans. But I think that is the problem by itself. It was hard to listen to because there has been a fashionable narrative pushed by everybody, not the media, but everybody in this country who is not black. Asians have said it, well, somewhat, as they're robbing our communities. Indians, not Native Americans, but literally people from India. All these groups look down on black people because they live in America and it's fashionable to do so. But yet, every single group and person would say things are getting better, things have gotten better. And they would have started saying it at the end of the 70s. even though this was, forget about being a misstatement, this was a lie. I heard it throughout my younger years. And because I heard it so often, I started to believe it. I ignored the racist things that my friends said in high school. I went to a predominantly white high school. I ignored the racist things that they would say, the comments that they would make. I ignored it. Because everything was getting so much better. Of course, when O.J. Simpson happened, that was revealed to be a lie. But I chalked it up to a one-time thing. It just wasn't an everyday thing. But looking back, absolutely was an everyday thing. Things are getting better. It's a lie. 100% it's a lie. And if, for those of you out there who want to say that the counter-protests in Boston proves that things are getting dramatically better, that racism is being confronted, I remind you of the fervor of these same people, not just in Boston, but across the country, to Barack Obama. There were not nice things being spoken about that man. They didn't like him, not because he was a terrible president. That was part of it, to them anyway. He was a terrible president to them. But there was always racial undertones to what they were talking about. Always. And to those of you conservatives who want to say, oh, well, these aren't the real conservatives, neoconservatism was born out of racism. And these Republican national leaders or what have you who want to come out and say, oh, we're so sorry for the Southern strategy. Too little, too late, go to hell. Go to hell. Because this is you. If these individuals who were in Charlottesville and gathering under the banner alt-right were not called fascists, neo-Nazis, or any of the other dismissive terms that you like to slap on people who you don't want to necessarily be associated with, but they were called, I don't know, let's pick a name, the Tea Party, as they were during the Obama administration. Or maybe they might have been called, let me pick another name. How about the neo-neoconservatives? If they were called something like that, and there wasn't this label of fascism and neo-Nazi on them, they would be as accepted as the neoconservatives were. They would be as accepted as the neoconservatives were. I don't believe any of this mess about people being up in arms about it. They're up in arms because of the name. Nobody wants to be affiliated with so-called fascists, even though most of conservatism is fascism. It talks openly and brazenly about the government being taken over and controlled by business people. In fact, I have had so many discussions when I used to care about this stuff and believe that you can actually change the hearts and minds of the people who believe this. Oftentimes you can't. I had so many discussions in the first decade of this century about the idea of corporate power and the ability of corporations to control and manipulate the government, which the arguments usually devolved into the concept that the other person was presenting, of them saying, look, if the country was run like a business, it would do much better. And I remember hearing this, by the way, in the 90s from conservative, and before I knew they were conservative, but pundits and contributors on television, mainstream television. I'm not talking cable channels now. I'm talking about your networks that everybody received across the country, if they had cable or not. This presidency of Donald Trump, the businessman, what was he, the negotiator who can get things done, you know, the art of the deal guy, this is a direct linkage to neoconservative ideology and the idea that businessmen know best for the government. That is fascism in its nutshell. If these people weren't being called fascists, then the only real reason they're being called fascists is because it's easy to paint them that way. If they were not being called fascists, their ideology, and if they weren't acting so buffoonish, their ideology would be readily acceptable. mind you, the people who are denouncing these individuals, they're only denouncing them because of their name. And they're only denouncing the name. They are not denouncing the ideology. They're not denouncing the philosophy. Because if you dig, and you don't have to dig far, this is, I'm going to take a shovel, stick it in the ground, and just lift a little dirt once, and boom, there it is. If you dig into both neoliberal and neoconservative rhetoric, it is fascism rebranded. It is the idea of fascism rebranded. And that's something that people do not want to accept. They don't want to admit that. They don't want to admit that people are only denouncing these guys because of the names associated with them. The alt-right is the Tea Party. The alt-right is the Tea Party. And yet, just a year ago, the Tea Party was a viable political movement. Not only viable, it had to be taken seriously. Understand that even presently, even right now, the conservative Republicans in the two houses will not work to kick out the Tea Party. In fact, the Republicans are doubling down wherever they are running candidates. They are running candidates in 2018. You'll see the same thing. They'll run candidates further to the right. When do we stop saying further to the right and start saying what it is? They are running fascists, unintellectual people to run the government. These people are authoritarians. They do not believe in compromise. They only believe in their way or the highway. And if you do not want what they want, they'll just keep out. They'll keep getting people into office until they outnumber you, and then they can shove through what they want. These people are absolute fascists. But you're not going to tell. We are not going to say that the Tea Party is a fascistic group. We are not going to say that the Tea Party should not be considered Republican, that they are fascists. But we will say it about these people, because guess what? Most of these people are middle and lower class people. And when I say middle class, I'm not talking about, you know, $500,000, $600,000, even though there was probably some of them in there. These people are lower than that. They are, you know, maybe $100,000. But I'm going to bet that they're more around the $50,000 to $75,000 range. Another point that needs, let me say that this is massively, massively important, because these were rich people. The Tea Party, for instance, the Tea Party was a bunch of individuals with hundreds of thousands of dollars in the bank, which is why they were taken seriously. Some of them were even millionaires, some of them tens of millionaires, some of them hundreds of millionaires, and probably a few of them billionaires. But these people are the undesirables. They are the ones who are the lowest of the lowest on the totem pole when it comes to right-wing nuttery. And so they can be denounced. They can be thrown out. But the ideology that they're expressing, it's no different than what the upper elite is expressing. None. None. And so we can't sit here and think that there's something different between them and the Tea Party and them and neoconservatism, because it's not. It's not. Newt Gingrich and the moral majority people really kicked this whole thing off. Really not kicked it off, but they kicked it into high gear. There was already a push of neoconservatism in the 70s, but it went through the 80s and gained some steam, but then it really took root and took hold in the early 90s, and then it's just been off since then. It's been off since then. And it's not going to get better, because Donald Trump is unpredictable. Pence, who I will tell you right now, ladies and gentlemen, I'm not even saying if he becomes president. I really believe right now it's a matter of when he becomes president. It's a matter of when he becomes president. Pence, when he becomes president, will be more unpredictable. He'll be effective. He'll be effective in getting things done. He'll be more effective than Donald Trump. But his predictability of what he's going to do and how it's going to impact Americans is going to be about the same as Donald Trump. But the impact will be worse, because he'll actually be in lockstep. And I mean that when I say that. It's not hyperbole. He'll be in lockstep with the fascists that are at the state level. And when I say this, you know, most people listen and they hear the word fascist and they're like, oh my God, listen to what you're saying. Mussolini said a bit about fascism. But the one thing that he said that most people remember, but they just completely move over it. It's not an issue. Is he said if he had to simply define fascism, it literally is the marriage of the state and the corporation. And that is what we are getting. ALEC, A-L-E-C, which has not been disbanded, which has not been outlawed in this country, is just like NAM, the National Association of Manufacturers, back in the 40s and the 50s, who both of these organizations were created by wealthy business people to prevent what then would be called liberal policies, which were very socially conscious and socially friendly, and more commonwealthian than capitalistic. Some people even said at that time that it was too socialistic, too communistic, but anything that doesn't allow corporations to run roughshod over people is considered socialism, communism, and, you know, the Red Scare. That's what it's about. That's what it's always been about. But they were both created to bring in this counter-revolution. It is not a revolution. A revolution pushes you forward. This pushes you back. A revolution allows for something to grow and flourish. This pushes you down. It suppresses you. That's a difference. That's a big difference. So ALEC has worked diligently over the last two decades. And it just, don't forget, it just came out as an organization working in this country back around 2010, if memory serves me correctly. It might have been 2011. They've been working, and they continue to work to write legislation and to get people elected. Some of the largest companies in this country, and indeed in the world, sit in this organization. And they work to elect people at the state and local level, along with the federal level, to put into place a fascistic mandate. Not neoconservative, not neoliberal. It is fascism. Understand, ladies and gentlemen, we are living in a fascist era. Now, I got to be honest, we've been living in a fascist era, as I've said many times before. That which was visited to, you know, black people and red people is now seeping out to be visited, it's now visiting the, I should say visited upon, the European American. And many of you don't understand what's going on. And many of you still have the thinking that if you support these people long enough, they will aid and comfort you. They will not. It is not in their interest. They don't care. And the sad part about it is, and I mean this, is the history of Europe suggests that this was going to be the outcome of America if Sutton didn't change. The history of Europe is a history built around royal families and inner circles built around those royal families, which completely mess over anybody not in that circle. Not only do they exploit them and crush them and abuse them and make them broken beyond repair, but they do so often that often there is and has been violent clashes between the security forces put in place to protect the royals and their circles and people who need to strike back because they don't have enough food, they don't have enough water, or they don't have enough time for family and friends. Public services are degrading, roads are degrading, things like that. And this for Western Europe, not counting Spain and Portugal, has been a recent evolution. And it should have, and actually, I was about to say should have something, but it should be noted, I was going to say, that it really came about after World War II. Because the devastation of Europe was so complete. The devastation of Europe was so complete that even the wealthy had to admit that changes were necessary. Even the wealthy had to admit that, yeah, okay, we need to change. Something needs to happen. But they forgot that devastation, and they are settling right back into their old patterns. The United States, as John O'Sullivan, who wrote the piece on Manifest Destiny, I read that piece, and another piece that he wrote called The Great Nation of Futurity. As he pointed out, because the United States has never, as he said, had a conflict to that level on these shores. He was writing this, of course, before the Civil War. But the U.S. has. It's been lucky. Even that was really fought in the South. Industry wasn't really big down there, so there wasn't really much devastation. But the United States hasn't had that. And so much of the clashes which have occurred over the past 100 and let's say 30, 40 years since capitalism has been instituted over here is because the upper elite in this country, and I use that loosely, but the upper circle, the royals, which we might as well call them the bankers right now, but the royals who control the economy and therefore control all the levers of power, and then their inner circles who do the same thing, they did exactly what the European royals in their inner circle did. Crushed Americans to the point where they had to fight back. This is why trade unions became very big in this country, because if it wasn't for those unions fighting constantly, there would have never been any capitulation. I know everybody, you know, the neoconservative and the conservative rhetoric says, oh, well, if you just let companies compete, they'll do the right thing. No, no, you don't. Zombies don't do the right thing. And that's what these are. These are living dead things. They're living dead things. They take over living bodies, kill the body, and then have it walk around like it's living. And that's what these things are. So, I fear, you know, because these people are the dispensable types, these the people who you were seeing protesting, I fear that what we're entering a period where, as the fascism rhetoric evolves to fit a public's palate, who they don't really, fascism, they fear it, but most people don't really know what fascism is. As it evolves to become more propagandizing, you're going to see things like this occur. Because they can then paint these people as nuts and crazy. We don't believe that. We're Americans, they'll say. We believe in free enterprise. We believe in freedom of speech. We believe in corporations having the right to buy politicians. But they won't say that. I mean, this, family, man, this is bad. I mean, it's bad. And I'm trying, you know, to be coherent and to put it all together, but it's just, it's bad. Because we don't, so many people don't get how it's natural in this country for this to occur. It's natural in this country for this to occur. And the fact that it hasn't occurred in 30 plus years has many people believing that it's not natural. And this is, it's suppressed. And just like anything, in nature, that you press down enough, it's sooner or later it's going to come back. It's going to spring back. Now, you can break something, but even when you break it, new generation will come to replace it. And if you break that generation, and you keep breaking those generations, you know what happens? Sooner or later, you get a generation that evolves to the point where it can't be broken. And time is speeding up. I don't know if all of you realize it and if all of you feel it, but time is speeding up. And I'm afraid we're entering a generation now that will not be broken. And they will stand up for some of the most egregious things because they can. They'll bring it back to the forefront, and either we'll deal with it, or we'll perish with it. My thinking is, we're going to perish with it. Something horrible will occur, and we will suffer great loss from it. And I don't mean that, you know, as a dire warning, ladies and gentlemen. It's more of a hint to be prepared. It's more of a hint to be prepared. I never in my life thought that we would be here. Just 8 months. Technically, I guess 6 months. After Barack Obama left office. I didn't believe we would be here. I hoped we wouldn't be here. I thought it would at least take a couple of years before the madness came about. I did. I absolutely did. But, you know, what can really be said about it? You know, for all of the criticisms that I have of the United States, I really do love this country. I really do. And all of the criticisms that I have of European Americans, I really do love most of them. There's a few that I don't really care for. But I never thought I'd get to the point where I was literally worried for this country. And I was worried for its ability to heal and to survive. A scenario keeps playing in my mind, ladies and gentlemen. It frightens me. The United States gets Trump out of office. Maybe Pence ascends. Pence is even crazier. But he lasts to 2020. He's actually limited in what he can do. So then, now, you get a Democrat. Or maybe you get another Republican, who knows? But you get a corporate Democrat. You get a corporate Democrat because the Democrats, again, screw their base. Screw blacks, screw progressives, screw liberals, and elect a manager who is ostensibly a Republican, but a rabidly corporate Democrat. And so now, 2022 comes up, and the progressives are starting to finally get their act together to mount real challenges to the Democrats. The Democrats start playing dirty politics, pulling dirty tricks. And they take 2022. Claim the House, maybe claim the Senate. Progressives are angry. Clashes in 2024 at the DNC convention. All the while, the Republicans themselves are being torn apart by this new breed of conservatism. And the country finds itself engulfed in political turmoil at every level. At every level. People are choosing sides. People are denouncing each other. And so, president, either from 2020 or from 2024, enters foolishly in a conflict overseas. And it goes horribly wrong. The U.S. sustains thousands, maybe tens of thousands of casualties. Maybe it's Korea, maybe it's China, maybe it's whoever. But it sparks a regional conflict that throws wherever they're at into massive, massive conflict and war. And for the first time, there are protests, significant protests, supporting and against the war since the Vietnam, of course, and the Vietnam War. And there are clashes in the street between protesters, literally violent clashes in the street. And this might happen before then. Police have to be called, possibly the military. Cities, towns, communities become locked off, and martial law is not used, but people are swooped up, put in jail, held in detention centers, you know, whatever. until the violence and the conflict can cease. And that leaves this country vulnerable. As that conflict spins out of control, it pulls in, draws in Russia or China. And this then causes the United States to declare war on Russia or China. And they overplay their hand. And one of those two countries end up with carriers off the coast of the United States bombing and shelling communities on this continent. I fear that. And it's been playing in my mind repeatedly since Trump won the presidency. Maybe I'm seeing something where there's nothing. But it's been there. It's been there. I guess on that depressing note, if you have any questions, comments, concerns, you can reach out to me. Yeah, this was a heavy one. This was a heavy one. So, as for the new structure of this show, that'll definitely be coming up in the next few months. I'm trying to decide if I'm going to wait till the new year or just at the end of the month. Or excuse me, at the end of the year. Anyway, we'll definitely get some work on that. So, this is your brother Vladimir Deese. Peace to all of you. Much love to you. See you on the other side. Ah, that'll be next time. See you next time, ladies and gentlemen. Peace.
There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again. How the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone. And there are lives in the balance.
Thank you.